Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
And that was some kind of weekend, wasn't it? Hell of a weekend. San Francisco started the weekend off with a dominant win over the Vikings. A dominant win over the Vikes, and then an amazing post-game soundbite from Richard Sherman.
It was man coverage. You know, I get tired of hearing, oh man, he's a zone corner. I get tired of hearing the excuses for why I'm great. It was man coverage. I covered the man. I picked the ball off. In the playoffs, in big games, I show up. I show up year in, year out, whether it's 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. Unless I tear my Achilles, I'm out there and I'm doing my job at a high level. And I think I get tired of the excuses, you know, for why I'm good. Oh, my God, they're playing zone. Oh, my God, it was this guy. Oh, my God, the receiver slipped. Oh, my God. It's like, why don't other people get those ops then? You know what I mean? It's a lot of other corners out there who have the same ops I have, you know. It's odd. It's like people got frustrated that I was so confident early on in my career. I was so confident early on so that people wanted me to fail. And when I didn't fail, it's like, how do we tear him down in other ways? How do we find a way to tear him down? You know what I mean? How do we find a way to rip his game apart? Because I'm too consistent on a year-in, year-out basis. You know, since I got in the league, every category that matters to a corner, I'm number one in.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, this is a big Richard Sherman house. You know what it is if I'm going to play a soundbite that runs 90 seconds. This guy's amazing. I love the beginning of that when he says, I'm sick of all the excuses as for why I'm great. How many guys can look you right in the eye and say, hey, listen, look at me. I am great. Stop trying to make excuses for why I'm great.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game.
You know, he might be. He might be even post Achilles tear. I know he's still the best quote in the game. Vikings, Niners, good game. But that soundbite was the best part of that game. And it normally is if we're lucky enough to have somebody stick a mic or a camera in Sherm's face, especially after he makes a play. Like he said, unless he's got it a shredded Achilles, this dude always delivers, especially on the big stage, both on and off the field. And then, all hell broke loose in Baltimore. But what went down in Baltimore was tame compared to yesterday in Kansas City. So I'll get to the Titans and the Ravens in a minute, but first, I've got to start with Houston at KC. Because Baltimore's start to their game was brutal, but then KC saw Baltimore and shouted, hey y'all, watch this!
Hey y'all, watch this.
You think that's bad? You think that's blowing a golden opportunity? We can do so much better. And by so much better, I mean so much worse. Let's give up a touchdown on Houston's opening drive. Not just a touchdown, but a wide open touchdown.
Wants it to throw. Airs it out. Left side. Downfield. Stills across the 25, 20, 15, 10, 5. Rock and roll. Houston strikes first.
Dude, there was nobody within 20 yards of that cat. That was bad. That was bad. But again, they had to be thinking, yeah, but we can do so much worse. Why don't we start dropping every ball thrown our way? Yeah, we can do that. But we can still do worse. How about a punt blocked on our first possession? Check.
Back inside the 11-yard line. Snap on target. And the Texans block it. It's loose at the 10-yard line. Lottie to the right side. The 5. He's in. Touchdown, Houston. A special team score.
Texans radio. Kansas City was already down 14-0. The game wasn't even 5 minutes old. KC fans were stunned. They were stunned and they were about to get pissed. Because everything that Kansas City had done so well during the regular season was about to go right out the window. The Chiefs had good special teams in the regular season. In fact, not just good, really good. Number one, according to PFF. A great specials team unit that promptly allowed a punt block on the big stage. And then chased it with this.
He puts him back there when it's important.
Big hang time. Ball is fumbled by Hill. Down at the 6 in a fight for the football.
I mean, how huge is this right here?
Here was Tyreek Hill, who had one punt return on the whole year. But Andy Reid and the Chiefs felt like, well, it's going to be Houston football.
How huge? Really huge. And that's not all. That was followed by this.
Second and goal. Watson puts the leg down. Here's the snap. Deshaun to throw over the middle. Got a man. Fells. Touchdown, Houston. Up 3 TDs to nothing.
Like the damnedest thing ever. Even for the Chiefs, which I will get to in a minute. But 21-0. Texans and Chiefs fans were booing at that point. Because nobody saw that coming. Nobody at all. Although maybe you should have after Saturday night. But even then, if you thought that Houston would get out to a great start, There was still no way you saw Houston being up on them 21-0 in the first quarter and the home fans booing already. Because that was every KC fan's worst nightmare. I mean, sure, they've had some devastating playoff defeats. Sure, Chiefs fan, you are conditioned to expect the worst this time of year. Except admit it, this time it was going to be different. This time it was going to be different because your team was better. And just as importantly, it was going to be different this time because everything had lined up perfectly. You got the bye, thanks to Miami. You got home field for the rest of the playoffs, thanks to Tennessee. It was going to be different because it was all setting up perfectly. The easiest path to the Super Bowl had opened right up. But deep down, then again, we are talking about the Chiefs and we are talking about the playoffs. And you've got so much freaking scar tissue that deep down you had to be worried. You had to be fearing the worst. You had to be thinking your team was going to find a way to blow it. The Kansas City was going to go Kansas City. And then sure enough, right on cue, they did. At least this time, the team that had tortured you in the past had the decency to get it over with an early, clean kill yesterday. You know, the decency to put you out of your misery quickly, the decency to choke you out in the first quarter and then let you relax for the next three. And then Houston was driving with that 21-0 lead, looking to go up four TDs and run a stake right through your heart. They were going to finish you right then and there in the first quarter. But then, in the first of a series of whack decisions by Bill O'Brien, they opt for a 31-yard field goal instead of trying to convert fourth and one from the 13 with Deshaun Watson. Like, they had their hands right around your throat. But instead of choking you out, they let go. They went for the brake instead of the gas. And then everything changed. Now, I'm not going to come in here and say that going for the field goal and that taking the points and playing it safe explains what happened next. I'm going to give Kansas City the credit. I'm going to say Kansas City made that happen. But Houston obviously had something to do with this. They were willing accomplices. The Texans were active in their own destruction. Hell yes, they were. Starting with the kickoff after the field goal, which got returned to the Houston 42. Like, if the Chiefs were looking for a spark, they found it. And then Pat Mahomes dumped gasoline all over that spark two plays later.
Middle blitz picked up. Left side throw caught. 10-5 touchdown. Damian Williams touchdown. Kansas City on a quick shoot route to the running back for 17 yards and a touchdown.
Chiefs radio. And now it's 24-7. Houston, except Arrowhead had been awoken. And so had the Texans' ability to blow games. Because on the very next possession, Houston did this.
And they fake it. They snap it to Reed, and he's stopped by Sorensen. They snap it to the up back, and Reed is denied.
Well, that's pretty freaking curious, isn't it? I mean, sure, you probably don't want to give the ball back to Kansas City and Mahomes. You don't want him getting into a rhythm and letting that crowd back in it, especially if your defense can't stop them. But if you aren't going to go for it on fourth and one from the KC 13, then what the hell are you doing going for a fake punt on fourth and four from your own 31? And if you really are going to do something like that, you sure as hell better convert it. Because if you don't, you know that's the one play everybody's going to point to for the rest of the game and then the entire offseason. Again, I'm all about playing aggressively. But where was that aggression on fourth and one when you had a chance to go up four touchdowns and possibly finish them right then and there? So you know what happens next, right? The Chiefs are not fooled. Sorensen blows it up. And not only are the Chiefs back in the game, suddenly they're holding the dagger. At that point, with the Texans fully imploding, it was not a question of if KC would win, but by how much. Because here's what happened next. Quick recap of the next few plays. KC TD. Houston fumbles the kickoff. KC TD. From 24-0 to 24-21 in 3 minutes and 24 seconds, that is the epitome of a choke job. And Houston was only getting started. They had so much more to give, so many more ways to melt down and choke, like another KC touchdown before halftime. So just think about that for a minute. Houston went from being up 24-0 with less than 11 minutes to go in the first half to trailing 28-24 going into halftime. That is nearly impossible to do. Now, if you told a team to blow a lead like that, I'm not sure they could have done it any better than Houston did. You know, I'm not saying this for effect. I mean this sincerely. Almost everybody I know now has trouble sleeping. Do you fit into that? Are racing thoughts overtaking your night of sleep? Are you tired of not being able to sleep? Do you have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep? If so, it's time for you to try Ebb. If you've tried everything from pills to pillows with little success, it is time for you to try Ebb. Ebb comfortably cools your forehead, and it helps to quiet the racing mind, and it promotes the natural onset of sleep. Ebb is the first and only wearable, drug-free solution that targets the root cause of sleeplessness, the racing thoughts. Ebb applies precise and continuous cooling to the forehead, which calms your mind. Plus, it's clinically validated, and 4 out of 5 users report falling asleep faster and improving overall sleep quality. Ebb Sleep is a wearable solution that fits over the forehead and gently and precisely cools the forehead to reduce those racing thoughts, and it allows people who are suffering from sleeplessness to drift more comfortably into a deeper, more restorative sleep. And Ebb Sleep is designed to work with your natural sleep-wake rhythms to allow you to get into that deep sleep more quickly. This is a real issue. Many people I know have trouble sleeping. You want to have the energy to do the things that you love again, and you need to get the sleep in order to do them. Ebb's natural solution has no morning side effects and allows you to get back to your peak performance. And right now, you can try Ebb risk-free for 60 nights to confirm that it is the solution you have been looking for. Go to tryebb.com/Rome. That's tryebb.com/Rome. Again, tryebb.com/Rome. Order today and get the sleep you need and deserve. And do me a favor, save this bull crap about if you had told the Texans before that game they'd be down just 4 going into halftime on the road in the AFC title game, they would have taken that all day long. The hell they would. Not if they were spotted a 24-point lead that could have been 28, and they were. And there was still so much more choking to do. That's why this rant is so long, because there was so much more choking to do, like coming out of halftime and giving up 2 more touchdowns to make it 41-24. 41 unanswered points. 41 unanswered points in a playoff game. That is straight stupid. And when Houston finally did get on the board again, KC scored yet again, giving them 7 straight touchdowns. It was like Houston jumped out to a lead and then decided to just nap it out. It went from the greatest win in team history to the greatest choke job in team history. And I'm not taking anything away from KC. They turned it around. Patrick Mahomes and that crew showed a ton of heart and character by finding a way to win when it would have been so much easier just to lay down trailing by 24. Instead, it was the Texans who stopped playing, not the Chiefs. But as much as this is about what KC did, it's also about how Houston absolutely self-destructed. And the meltdown starts at the very top. Is there anybody in that league that you trust less with a 24-0 lead than Bill O'Brien? Like, don't get me wrong. I mean, the guy does know a lot about football. A lot. But he's one of the few guys wearing a headset that makes a 24-0 lead seem shaky. That it's not like that call sheet should be going up on Romeo Crennel's mantelpiece either. Like, I know the Texans were banged up defensively and the KC is loaded, but you couldn't get one stop. You couldn't get a single stop at any point during that run of 7 straight TDs. I mean, get the hell off the field. Even once? That was too much to ask? Apparently it was. So from scoreless in the first quarter to putting up 51 for the game, it's a hell of a swing by KC's offense and one hell of a meltdown and tank job by Houston's defense. It got so bad at one point that the scoreboard in Arrowhead claimed that they had run out of fireworks to shoot after TDs. Yeah, but don't bring any of this around O'Brien. Don't bring any of this around Bill. He seems to think that overall, things are actually pretty damn good.
You know, I feel like we're moving in the right direction.
Wait, what? I feel like we're moving in the right direction.
You know, I feel like we're moving in the right direction.
My man, you just turned a 24-point lead into a 20-point beatdown in a playoff game. That's not moving in the right direction. In fact, that's pretty much the opposite of moving in the right direction. Like, I know you're talking about the overall direction of the organization, but that was a soul-snatching loss. The kind of thing that can destroy a team for years. The type of thing that stays with anyone and everyone who had anything to do with it for the rest of their lives. It's always going to be there. Just ask the Falcons. Ask them what 28-3 means to them. You think any of them were saying, oh, we're moving in the right direction after that? Last time I saw a team implode like that in the playoffs, coaches were punching each other on the sideline. And now Kansas City is advancing, and Houston's got to try to figure out what the hell just happened. Or better yet, what the hell they just did to themselves. As I tweeted last night, Bill O'Brien, the GM, is going to have a long talk with Bill O'Brien, the head coach, when he gets back to Houston. The question then is, does the GM fire the coach? And if so, does the owner then fire the GM? Because that choke job was that bad. Credit KC for not laying down with that giant deficit. Just make sure you crack the Texans for lying down with that giant lead, because that's exactly what they did. You can follow him on Twitter at Tom Pelissero. He joins us right now. Tom, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm hanging in, Jim. 3 weeks till Super Bowl Sunday. Let's do this.
I hear you, Tom. Exactly. All right, so there are a number of pieces of coaching and personnel moves that I want to get to shortly, but you were covering the Vikings-Niners on Saturday. One of the talking points going into the game was about Adam Thielen's ankle. What had you heard before the game, and what do you make of the way he played?
Well, it was a bizarre situation in practice where a teammate's cleat basically goes through the back of his sock, tears up his ankle. He's bleeding. Teammates are panicking. He reaches down, feels his own Achilles, realizes it's intact, but he had to get 4 stitches put in there. It was a scary situation. He was able to tape it up, go out there and play, no real effect. You know, the bigger issue for the Vikings was just they seemed to run out of gas. They were still, as badly as the numbers ended up, they were still in that game midway through the third quarter till, you know, there's a miscommunication. Thielen cuts off a route. Kirk Cousins thinks he's going to keep running. It's an interception, game turning, the field got tilted, and anytime a team runs 47 times on you, you're probably not winning that game.
Tom Pelissero joining us. In fact, I was going there next because San Francisco kicked a field goal coming out of halftime to make it 17-10. But to your point, on Minnesota's first possession, Sherman does pick off Cousins. What was your reaction, though, as that play was unfolding?
Well, I was watching it through binoculars in the press box, and the moment you see it, you realize this is just a situation where it's a route where Kirk thinks he's going to carry it through. Sherman's got the inside track on him, which is why I think Thielen settles down there. Cousins just throws the ball in the wrong spot. I mean, it's a great read by Richard Sherman. It's also just, you know, one of those things that happens sometimes when you're trying to go up against a scheme like the 49ers. You know, one thing that their defensive coordinator, Robert Saleh, did that was really impressive in that game was he mixed up their fronts. They were constantly moving around those defensive linemen. They go against that scheme all the time in practice. Gary Kubiak, who's with the Vikings, working with Kevin Stefanski this past year, he learned under, of course, Mike Shanahan. It's the Kyle Shanahan system. They see that every single day in practice. By moving around the defensive linemen, what you do is you keep the offensive linemen from knowing where your guys are going to be so they can't tee off on you. And that's why part of why the 49ers dominated the line of scrimmage. Don't get me wrong. They got some really, really good players up there, but anytime you challenge the target points against that type of a running game, that's how you bottle up Dalvin Cook to the point that he's non-factor like he was on Saturday.
Tom Pelissero joining us and breaking it down. I want to get back to Stefanski and Saleh in a minute, but what about the back end? Like, for instance, you reported before the game the Vikings were going to take some shots at 49ers DB Akella Witherspoon. He was ultimately replaced in that game by Emmanuel Mosley. What did Minnesota see that let them think they could have that kind of success against him? And then how big of a concern is that cornerback spot for San Francisco moving forward?
Well, Kevin Stefanski is a guy who always consults, you know, the analytics departments. He wants a lot of numbers. You know, one thing that the Vikings had seen was that Akella Witherspoon was vulnerable on go balls, that you could take him deep. Sure enough, they do it on the second drive of the game. Maybe they did that too soon. Maybe they should have kept him out there longer, because that was the last play, I think, that we saw Witherspoon playing that side of the field. You know, they felt like that was a vulnerability that they could attack. They had a second chance, same side of the field. It was after Mosley took over. But they had another chance to go deep, and the ball was a little bit underthrown. Diggs was not able to come back and get it. You know, it's hard for the Vikings when you're built everything around the running game and playing to your defense. If you can't run the football and you're always in second and third and intermediate, to have Kirk Cousins dropping back 30 times, ask guys like Riley Reiff and then Rashad Hill, who had to take over a right tackle because Brian O'Neill got a concussion on that shot he took from Nick Bosa. It's tough to say you got to now go single block Bosa and D Ford and these guys. You know, they were outmatched, and that showed up in how much Cousins was, you know, he was sacked 6 times. He got hit a bunch more. They just weren't able to move him around the way that they were hoping to.
Tom Pelissero joining us. He's with NFL Network and NFL.com. So, Tom, what about Stefanski and Robert Saleh? I mean, it's kind of interesting in that it's a battle between two candidates for the Browns' head coaching job, and Stefanski, the guy who does not win, ends up getting that gig. So why was that their call, and what kind of a coach are they getting in Stefanski?
Kevin Stefanski was always going to be one of the front runners for that job because he was a finalist last year. Remember, you had John Dorsey, who was the GM at that point. He favored Freddie Kitchens. He did not want to disrupt what they seemed to be building the second half of the 2017 season with Freddie Kitchens as the play caller, that relationship that he had with Baker. You also have this other faction, Paul DePodesta, who lives out there in California, former baseball executive, heavy on the analytics side. They brought him in about 4 years ago to be their chief strategy officer. In that time, the Browns' strategy has changed two or three times. They've gone full analytics in the Sashi Brown era. Then they've swung all the way back to the full football side with John Dorsey. Now, again, you're going to the analytics side. DePodesta was running the search. It was extremely unique. You know, some of the candidates they brought to the building in Berea, Ohio, those candidates were able to meet with a variety of people in the organization. But for people like Stefanski, the traveling party did not include any quote-unquote football people. It was Jimmy Haslam, his son-in-law, J.W., as well as Paul DePodesta and their cap guy, Chris Cooper. So the interviews were not drawn up here, show me an inside zone on the whiteboard. No, it was just about leadership qualities. How can you fit into what we want to do, the way we want to communicate with the analytics department on the game plans? It's going to be a really unique setup here, you know, regardless of who they bring in to be the general manager, because they're approaching this a little bit differently. The one thing I know about Stefanski, listen, this guy was hired in 2006 by the Vikings to be Brad Childress's assistant, not assistant coach, his assistant. He went from there to coach in several different positions to eventually becoming the offensive coordinator, built strong relationships with players. He is loved in that Vikings locker room, and he has a reputation for being very cool-headed, able to work with anybody, and he's going to have to because they want a very collaborative approach now to try to turn the Browns around.
And it sure seems like the model has changed, and not just for them, but as you look around the NFL, Tom Pelissero joining us. And to that point, speaking of head coaches, Tom, I thought you had a fascinating piece with Mike McCarthy last month. Your colleague Jane Slater was on this show last week. She said it was so good that you deserve 10% of McCarthy's salary. Before we get into the actual content, how did that piece come to be? How did that come about?
I appreciate Jane saying that, but I'm pretty sure that check is not coming. I've known Mike McCarthy for a long time. I was on the Packers beat for the Green Bay Press Gazette circa 2007 when they made their last NFC Championship run with Brett Favre as the quarterback. And so, you know, when Mike got let go, and there was a lot of stuff that was said and written about him, there was that extensive Bleacher Report article contained certain accusations about the relationship between McCarthy and Aaron Rodgers, among other things. Mike took some shots there. And so I happened to be out there in August for training camp. I called Mike. We got together, just talked, not talking about doing a story, but just talked. And it was obvious at that point that he was really diving in and doing some stuff. He wasn't sitting around. He was still living in the Green Bay area. That's the crazy thing. You know, he had a knee surgery, which was performed across the street from Lambeau Field. So he's literally driving right by like a week after he's fired. People are seeing him. He's still around. He lived there for the entire year, but he wasn't wallowing. You know, he really wanted to dive back in and do it the right way. You know, there's probably some coaches who have won a Super Bowl and been to the playoffs 9 times, and, you know, you're just hoping for a multi-million-dollar payday. You can kind of treat it like a retirement job. That's not McCarthy. You know, when he was telling me about he's got these coaches that he's working with, Jim Haslett and Frank Sabetti Jr. and these guys, they're moving into this. He built this giant barn. It's basically an outsized man cave behind his house. It's got living quarters. So, like, Haslett and Cignetti and these guys would just move in for a week every month, and they just, you know, dawn till dusk, go through tapes, study trends, dive into analytics, and study, you know, everything, officiate, take a 360-degree view of it. You know, I said it'd be a great story if you would let us come in and shoot this sometime. And so, sure enough, got to mid-November as this thing started becoming more real. He was super open with us. There's even stuff, you know, on the cutting room floor. He took us over to the Packers Hall of Fame where he's got all of his, you know, playbooks and philosophical stuff, old quarterback school tapes and things going back to the 1990s. Really cool because he's a guy who's got a long history. He won over 61% of his games in Green Bay. I don't care who your quarterback is. That's impressive. But he's also really trying to evolve. And he says he's going to be a better coach. He says he wants to go in, build it the right way, try to win them all. And he ends up in a spot in Dallas with a quarterback, Dak Prescott, who You know, funny enough, we were sitting there watching tape of him and how he liked Dak, how he'd get into rhythm on some of those, you know, deep passing plays and things like that. He's impressed with that quarterback, and I'll be really interested to see what he's able to do with him.
Tom Pelissero joining us. Again, I can't stress this enough. This is amazing to me because when guys lose their jobs, often you'll see them take a little bit of time. Maybe they'll travel around, spend some time with some other coaches or some other staffs and take some notes, and they try to get themselves back together. This guy literally had that whole facility built, and he brought guys in, and they moved in with him, and they went about it every single day. Like, I've never seen anything like this before. What about those assistants, Tom? Were they promised, can you get a sense, were they promised a position with him, or were they doing it also to evolve and improve themselves?
Well, the plan going along was that those guys would be a part of the staff. Now, Cignetti actually took the job as the offensive coordinator at Boston College, so he ended up with an opportunity. He went out there. Scott McCurley is expected to be part of the staff. I believe Jim Haslett in some capacity. He's not going to be the defensive coordinator. That's going to be Mike Nolan. And McCarthy's building a hell of a staff down there with John Bones Fossil from the Rams coming over. That was a coup to be able to bring him in. But yeah, they were, you know, working together. I mean, these guys had two giant whiteboards in this, you know, we're in the man cave, so he's got, like, you know, pinball machines and a pool table. It's all just covered. There's just whiteboards and stuff. And they've got everything mapped out, the entire calendar from what they're going to do in OTAs through mini camp, through training camp, like down to the letter of how they're going to build every department, the technology department, video. He's talking about mental health resources. I mean, you got a lot of time on your hands, and they actually had a chance now to step back, figure all that stuff out. So, you know, the plan was walk in the door, you know, flip on the lights and go to work. You know, in Dallas, you know you're never going to be short on resources, and McCarthy's got a lot of big ideas of how he's going to build that thing.
And it worked. It worked. He got the gig. All right, so final thought, as you mentioned, Tom, you covered the Packers back in the day. So what are your quick thoughts about a Packers 49ers NFC Championship game?
I think you saw yesterday what still makes the Packers so dangerous is that we have, over the course of this season, seen a Packers team that's won, what, 13, 14 games now, with Aaron Rodgers playing at an above-average level. This has not been 500 yards every week, scoring 35 points a game. Their numbers are not that different statistically than they were a year ago when everybody wanted Mike McCarthy run out of town because the offense was struggling. No, they put money into the defense. Za'Darius Smith and Preston Smith, those guys have made a huge impact. They were never free agent players in the past, but Brian Gutekunst made a couple of really good bets on those guys. The running game has been better with Aaron Jones. And then when they need Rodgers to make those big throws, the couple of third downs in the fourth quarter yesterday, that's vintage Aaron Rodgers. I mean, he doesn't need to put the entire team on his back. This is probably the most balanced Packers team that they have had in the Rodgers era. You know, if you're the 49ers right now, you're not necessarily saying, you know, the end-all be-all is stopping Rodgers. But boy, in those big-time moments, you better hope Bosa and D. Ford and those guys can get after him because 12 can still make those plays.
And then a really quick follow, Tom. Do you think that they can keep Aaron Rodgers clean enough for him to do what he does?
Run the football. They got to watch that tape. It's, again, Matt LaFleur, the Packers coach, comes out of that same system. You know, former Kyle Shanahan assistant going back to their days together in Washington and later in Atlanta. So it's going to be the same thing. They're going to have to learn from that tape. What does Robert Saleh throw at him? Can they figure out some counters to be able to get Aaron Jones going? That chess match between two guys who know each other well. It's going to be one of the really interesting storylines in that game.
So as stunning as Houston getting up on Kansas City was, and as stunning as Kansas City's comeback was, let's not let that erase what happened in Baltimore on Saturday night. Because the Ravens choked. Yeah, I said it. Well, actually, I didn't say it. I'm not saying it. But Ravens Pro Bowl corner, Marlon Humphrey, said it. He said it in the locker room after Baltimore got smoked by Tennessee.
You know, you got to look yourself in the mirror, and I think it's this team right now, his identity is to get the playoffs and choke. And just, you know, it is what it is. That's just the hard truth.
It is what it is, and what it is astounding. That's an unbelievable thing for a guy to say. An unbelievable thing for a player to say about his team. He just said it. This team's identity is to get in the playoffs and choke. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that's some heat-of-the-moment stuff after a gutting loss. And in the morning, when the emotions are not nearly as raw, or maybe after somebody from the team had spoken to him, or a coach, or a teammate, and he had a night to sleep on it, he'd walk it back. No, he did not.
I stand by that. It's actually what I was thinking on the sideline. It's crazy, you know, you are what you show on paper, and you are what you show on the field, and that's what we've shown on the field.
So this guy had a chance to sleep on it, And then that's what he said the day after. I mean, that's like the coldest self-assessment ever. And it might be the rare time when I'm actually going to disagree with a guy who's killing his own team. Because choker is a hard word. That's a tough word. And honestly, when I look at Baltimore and I look at what happened to them on Saturday night, I don't see chokers. The Texans, yes, they choked. Not with the Ravens. Now, it is two straight seasons when they got to the postseason and got bounced immediately. I know both of those losses came at home. And that they got manhandled and beaten at their own game by the Titans on Saturday night. And yes, that was a terrible loss. I could even argue that was a terrible no-show by the Ravens. But you've got to do it more than just twice for it to be your identity. And especially if you're saying it's your identity as a choker. I'm not saying either one of those losses were good. I'm not saying that either one of those losses won't leave a mark. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm not saying it's all good. It's not. Far from it. Last year, they ran into a Chargers buzzsaw. This year, they ran into a Derrick Henry buzzsaw. Brutal losses, both of them. Horrible ways to end the season, especially this season when they had all put themselves in a position to win it all, only to get wrecked by a team that they were allegedly so much better than. Ravens linebacker Matthew Judon said this after the game.
You don't never expect to get into a car crash until you getting into a car crash, and I feel like that's what it is.
Except that wasn't a car crash. That wasn't a car they got hit by. That was a tractor. A tractor-cito. Because Derrick Henry just put an absolute beating on anybody and everybody in his path, including Earl Thomas. Now, I like Earl Thomas a lot. I always have. I've got nothing but respect for Earl Thomas and his game. But I have never seen a defensive player get turned around and used as a blocker the way Henry did Thomas. And that's after Thomas said before that game. Remember, do you remember what Thomas said before that game as it related to Derrick Henry?
Guys didn't seem like they was too interested in tackling him. So I think our mindset is a little different. I think we're going to try to tackle him. We're going to try to swarm. And we're going to see how it plays out.
Yeah, well, it did not play out well at all for Earl. My man got turned inside out. I mean, almost literally. After the game, Henry was asked what he said to Thomas, and his answer was perfect.
I just said, good to see you, Earl. I said, good to see you, man. And, you know, hope we can do this again.
Wow. And I'm also not that interested in hearing that rest v. rust argument. Rest is a privilege that you earn this time of year. And if you can't manage it or you can't handle it, that's your fault and nobody else's. And it sure seemed like the Ravens receivers couldn't handle the ball. And their defense sure as hell couldn't handle Derrick Henry. Because when he wasn't trucking fools, he was just throwing over them.
Titans in the pistol. Mariota. Now he goes in motion. Direct snap. Derrick Henry throws it. Jump pass in the end zone. Touchdown, Titans! Henry to Corey Davis. Oh my goodness, that play is from the 1800s.
Something like that. Titans radio. And as long as we're talking about respect, how about a little bit of love for Ryan Tannehill? I tweeted this too, but this guy was run out of Miami. And now he's 60 minutes away from going to the Super Bowl in Miami, which is awesome. About as awesome as that game plan that Mike Vrabel and his staff drew up. You tell me who had the better game, Titans offensive coordinator Arthur Smith or Titans D coordinator Dean Pease? And the answer is, it's pretty much a tie. They both coached their asses off and had that team ready to not only win, but to dominate. And one more thing on that game. As I mentioned, I do appreciate Marlon Humphrey's self-reflection and the willingness to really ask the tough questions of himself and his team. That was an all-time no-show by Baltimore at the worst possible time. But people trying to make that out like Lamar Jackson is a bust or a playoff failure are so desperate and so transparent. Like, don't even come in here with that junk. That is like the dumbest and worst take ever. Yeah, right. Because the best player in the NFL this year, the guy who just turned the entire league inside out this year, is an all-time bust and playing the wrong position because he had a bad game in the playoffs, a bad game against a really good team with a great scheme and receivers who were just putting the ball on the ground. Except some fools and dopes want to say, you see, this proves that all the doubters were right all along. Yeah, it sure as hell doesn't prove that. You know what it does prove? It proves that some of you have got some axe to grind with Jackson, and you're doing whatever you can to try to make that point. You're making that point, and the point's about you, not about him. Brett Favre once threw 6 picks in a playoff game. So get out of here with that trash that one playoff game tells you all you need to know. That one playoff game proves anything at all, even. Look, I'm not going to come in here and say that Jackson had a great game. He didn't. Even if he did have more than 500 total yards. But most of them came when it really didn't matter. He did not have a good game. He'd be the first one to tell you he didn't have a good game. He'd be the first one to tell you it was a terrible time for a terrible game. He'd be the first guy to own it. But he did damn near drag them back into that game in the second half. And that showed me something. In fact, it showed me a lot. So if you're trying to trash Jackson after that game and say he's overrated or no good, that shows me a lot too. It says everything about you and nothing about him. And no, that does not mean that you were, quote, right. Because pretty much almost every other team in the NFL would take that guy, gladly. And it would be an upgrade over what they currently have. And the guy played at an MVP clip the entire year. Now, that doesn't tell me about him. It tells me about you and your agenda. Hey, clones, the question of the day. What do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? I can tell you what we don't want. We don't want another bar or another sugary snack or another energy drink. No, instead we want beef, pure and simple. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. It's not shriveled. It's not dry. It's not tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. So it's tender and tasty. It's not tough. What makes it so good? I'm going to say it's the company behind it. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. And Old Trapper is packed with protein. It comes in four amazing flavors to satisfy all your cravings. It's quality smoked meat at its finest, and it goes wherever you go. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're purchasing. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Pat Forty. Pat, good to have you back. How are you?
Good to be with you, Mr. Rome. Thank you.
Pat, great to have you. I appreciate you making time. I know it's a busy day for you. So after a very long wait, Pat, we're finally a few hours away from the national championship game. What is the vibe like in New Orleans right now?
Oh, it is like festive to a feverish pitch, I think you would say. the French Quarter is always wild when you have a national championship game down here or a Sugar Bowl. When LSU is playing in it, it's up to another level, that you just really don't see much of anywhere else. So it is really a high, high level of anticipation from LSU fans. They haven't won a national title since 2007. This may be the best team in school history. But there's a lot of Clemson people here as well, and they're fired up. You know, they haven't seen their team lose for a couple of years. So a lot of confidence, a lot of anticipation for tonight.
We're talking to Pat Forty. So, Pat, in theory, the national championship game is played on a neutral field, but as you point out, we're talking about, you know, a 90-minute drive from Baton Rouge to New Orleans. So how significant is the home field advantage for LSU?
Well, we'll see how many people get in. I think that certainly it will be more LSU than Clemson, probably by a pretty substantial margin. But I'm also kind of wondering if spending 2 weeks or 16 days steeped in this home atmosphere basically might almost be a detriment for LSU, because that's a lot of time to hear people telling you about winning the championship and doing it in New Orleans, doing it at home. And I think in this situation, I'd rather be Clemson getting away from all of that for 4 or 5 days leading up to the game than having been here and listened to it all. Now, you know, like once again, that all goes away if, you know, Clemson can't even snap the ball without, you know, jumping off sides because they can't hear. So we'll see exactly how intense the atmosphere is in the dome. I'm not sure yet.
We're talking about Pat Forte, talking with Pat Forte. Pat, in terms of the matchup itself, you know, Joe Burrow had a historic season. He was absolutely incredible. And there's a lot of things that could be said about him, but I don't think that anything is more accurate than what Clemson defensive coordinator Brett Venables said about him, quote, "Joe Burrow is not some slappy," end quote. What do you think concerns Venables the most about Burrow?
You know, I think several things. First of all, Venables is the best game player defensive coordinator in college football. He confuses teams. He disguises blitzes and coverages. And it's hard to do against LSU because, A, Burrow is so smart, and, B, LSU lines up so fast that they basically make you kind of show your hand before the snap. And so a lot of that element of surprise and disguise, I think, will be challenged here. So, you know, Burrow, not only accurate, tough, poised, but a good athlete, too, and that's the other thing. If they do get pressure on him, he can run away from it, as can Trevor Lawrence. These are both very athletic quarterbacks.
We're talking to Pat Forte. So, Pat, what about that? Like, Venables has said that LSU's system is designed to get the defense to show what they're going to do before they do it. As you point out, Venables is as good as what he does as anybody else. So how do you expect him to counteract that? How much activity are you expecting to see before every single snap?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think if you're sitting at home as a fan wondering kind of what to look for, I think it's that. The game within the game, inside the game, in the 5 to 10 seconds between lining up and the ball being snapped, and how many people are moving around for Clemson. Is Joe Burrow moving, shifting protections in response? And then, yeah, what happens when it gets snapped? And I think that, you know, Venables will have some, he'll have some surprises for him, no doubt about it. You know, the question is, are they effective surprises? This is not their best defensive line by any stretch. That was last year when they had three guys drafted in the first round off the defensive line. So how do they come up with pressure? Do they have to bring extra guys to get in Joe Burrow's face? And then what does that cost them on the back end of coverage?
We're talking to Pat Forte. He is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Pat, one more thought about LSU. I mean, it's so easy to focus on Burrow, but when you look at the rest of the talent they have on offense, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, they got five NFL guys. You know, they've got three wide receivers who will play in the NFL. They've got a tight end, Thaddeus Moss, whose dad is Randy Moss, who's just come on incredibly well as the season has progressed. And then they've got Clyde Edwards-Helaire, running back, who, if its hamstring is healed all the way, he's another major threat. You know, he can catch the ball, he can run, he can block, he can do everything. So the talent around Burrow is elite, no doubt about it. But I would also say the same thing about the talent around Trevor Lawrence. All of those receivers are excellent, and the running back, Travis Etienne, as good as Clyde Edwards-Helaire is, I think Etienne's better.
All right, so on that side, Pat Forte joining us. You have a really interesting piece up right now, Pat, on SI.com. I want to ask you about Clemson defensive back Nolan Turner, who iced the game against Ohio State with that interception. Nolan is the son of Kevin Turner, the former NFL player who passed away 4 years ago at the age of 46. Kevin played fullback in a really physical and violent way. He was diagnosed with ALS and ultimately CTE. So what was it like to talk with Nolan about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously the family has had a very conflicted relationship with football. Football, you know, doctors looked at the autopsy results from Kevin Turner and feel absolutely certain that the unbelievable number of head-to-head blows that he endured as a player, he was a special teams head hunter, he was a fullback, he was, you know, a lot of collisions played a major part in his death. And so, you know, how does his son feel about playing that sport? And he loves it. He said, I love it too much. I'm not going to give it up. It's what I want to do. He said it was awful watching what happened to his dad, but, you know, he tries to play a little bit safer. But you're a safety. You're still going to be colliding with people. You're going to be making hits. And, you know, I think every time that he makes a tackle, his mom and grandfather probably are wincing and just hoping that, you know, everything's going to be okay.
Mm. Pat Forte joining us, and that piece is up right now on SI.com. You know, he had the interception, Pat, that ended that game against Ohio State, and Dabo said, quote, "The cool thing is, I told him right before, hey, you're going to have the game-winning interception. Get your dadgum head up," end quote. I mean, it's a vintage Dabo story, Pat. What do you make of how Dabo has coached and guided this particular team over the course of the season?
Yeah, I mean, amazing. You know, this team is probably not as talented as last year's overall, but they've won on the same level, and here they are again. And I do think that Dabo has a confidence in himself and in his players that really inspires them to play at a higher level. You know, and he's things like that. You know, like Nolan Turner was beaten for a big touchdown early in the fourth quarter. Dabo comes over to him afterwards and says, hey, you know, get your head up. You're going to make the interception that wins the game. And by golly, he did, you know. And I just think Dabo has that sort of charisma, this infectious sort of belief that his team's going to win. And I really do think it trickles down into the locker room. He might come across as a little bit of a hayseed, if you will, but he's not. You know, I think he likes kind of projecting that image. But he's a smart, savvy, charismatic guy.
I was going to say, Pat, where do you come out? I mean, like, you've seen everything. I know you can see through anything. I happen to love Dabo, but when you look at him, what is he? I mean, is he that savvy guy? Is he that hayseed? Is he something in between? You've covered everybody. What do you think when you look at him?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I do think that he likes that image that he projects, you know, a little bit self-effacing and a little bit, you know, like I just bounced off the turnip truck, and it's not the case, you know. I mean,
not at all.
In fact, if you go back to between his playing days and when he started coaching, he was making a lot of money selling commercial real estate. You know, I mean, he knows his way around things. And, you know, so I think that carries over. He's a, you know, his assistant coaches, he lets them get a ton of credit for game plan and scheme and that sort of thing, and they should. But Dabo is a much smarter guy, much savvier guy than he really cares to project at all to anybody.
So, Pat, before I let you go, like the masses are running to LSU, understandably so, as you and I talked about. They are loaded on both sides of the ball. But Clemson has won 29 straight. And when you do that, you start to develop a belief that you simply cannot lose. When you're dealing with college athletes, how powerful is that mindset?
I think it's huge. You know, I really do. Kids this age, you know, there are a few things less predictable in the world than 18 to 22-year-old males. And so if you can put some doubt into the other team, as good as they've been, if you can knock LSU's confidence a little bit, slow them down enough, get a turnover here or there, get a red zone stop, and make some things happen for yourself, I just think that unwavering confidence and belief that they are going to win helps them in the long run, and I think it's going to help them tonight.
Pat, before I get your prediction, let me ask you this. If the game were to turn into a shootout, can Clemson's offense stay with LSU's offense?
Yeah, well, I think that yes, I think that a shootout's entirely possible, and yeah, I think they can because their weapons are as good. You know, I mean, their receivers are outstanding. Justin Ross, T. Higgins, you know, Travis Etienne, as I said, I think he's the best back in this game, and you know, I think Trevor Lawrence is right there with Joe Burrow. You know, he may not have had as good a season as Burrow, but he's as good a player as Burrow is. And we've seen him do it when the chips were down. He goes 96 yards against Ohio State to win the game. You know, he'll run when he needs to. He's tough. He's smart. So, yes, I think that they can stay with them in a shootout, and I expect it to be a bit of a shootout.
All right, spoiler alert, you've called your shot. You predicted that Clemson will win. You kind of just laid it out for me, but is there anything else? What have you seen that makes you feel like Clemson's going to win?
You know, I think that they have been so solid defensively that they're going to get enough stops. And, the LSU defense I don't think is as good, and they're playing an offense that's almost as good as LSU. So, you know, I think that they're just – if there's one – slight weak link in this, it's the LSU defense, and I think that Clemson will do just enough to get enough stops and win the game. I picked 37-35, so I think there's going to be plenty of points and hopefully a lot of drama.
All right, so let's go back to the NFL for a minute. And again, I think the timing of that is really interesting. Look at when they dropped that story. The Tennessee Titans have had a handful of memorable franchise moments since they packed up and they left H-Town a couple of decades back. From the legendary Music City Miracle to the devastating tackle that stopped Kevin Dyson 1 yard short of tying up the Super Bowl on the very last play of Super Bowl 34.
McNair drops, throws right side for Dyson. He dives for the end zone.
Didn't make it.
He came up 1 yard short.
Did not make it. So they've had some moments, some unforgettable moments. You can put Saturday's 28-12 beatdown of the Ravens, right near the top of that list. Now, maybe you were one of the few outside of Nashville calling that upset, but nobody saw the Titans turning the best team in the NFL, arguably, inside out, and ripping the rock from the best player in the NFL three different times. But that's exactly what happened. And the consequences could not be more dire. Not for the Ravens, but instead for the head coach who won, Mike Vrabel. Remember, it was Vrabel who made comments on a podcast back in July, and all of a sudden, as you might imagine, because of the nature of those comments, they are resurfacing all over again. Because the internet is in ink, and the internet has receipts. We all do. You might remember that over the summer, Vrabel hopped on a bus, and he recorded an hour-long podcast episode with offensive lineman Taylor Lewan and former Titans linebacker Will Compton. Among the myriad of topics that they discussed, there was this hypothetical scenario that ended up carrying the entire news cycle. You remember the hypothetical scenario put forth by Lewan, who asked his coach if he would be willing to cut off a certain body part if it meant winning another Super Bowl. Here's how the graphic exchange went.
Would you cut your off for a Super Bowl?
Oh, been married 20 years. Yeah, probably.
You've got three.
As a player. I guess we'll be married for 20 years one day.
Would you? If you came home.
You won't need it.
Would she be upset?
She'd probably be on board.
She would be like, do you want me to do it? Do you want to do it now?
That's an incredible exchange. I mean, guys being guys, players and their coach. Actually, that's what makes it amazing that a head coach went there. He's like, yeah, I've been married 20 years. Yeah, I'd do it. What would your wife say? Will you do it now? That is an amazing Alvin. That is an amazing exchange. Let me hear that one more time.
Would you cut your off for a Super Bowl?
That's a player asking the coach
been
that.
Married 20 years. Yeah, probably.
You've got three.
As a player. I guess we'll be married for 20 years one day.
If you came home,
you won't need it.
Would she be upset?
She'd probably be on board.
She would be like, do you want me to do it? Do you want to do it now?
Vrabel. I couldn't think more of the guy than I do after seeing what he did the last several weeks, but especially after resetting that. He said, you guys will be married for 20 years one day. You won't need it. And then he doubled down a couple of times with, you won't need it. You won't need it. Well, what would the wife say? Do you want me to do it? Do you want to do it now? Incredible. So he cites 20 years of marriage and says, yeah, you're not going to need that Johnson at that point. And then he said he'd be willing to bob it himself if it meant winning a Super Bowl as a coach. The guy's like, hey, whoa, 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 you have three. Yeah, but not as a coach. Apparently three as a player is not enough. So it's a wild exchange, made even more wild because all of a sudden, the Ryan Tannehill-led Titans are now just two games away from being the champions. And if you think that Taylor Lewan has forgotten about that conversation, then you do not know the Copenhagen-dipping, Gatorade-chugging Taylor Lewan. Because this is how 77 greeted Vrabel in front of the visitors' locker room after that win in Baltimore on Saturday night. All right, the audio is really tough to decipher. But let me help you out here. Don't get this twisted. That's Taylor Lewan bro-hugging his coach while yelling, quote, I hope you're ready because that piece is coming off. That piece is coming off. Let's go. That piece is coming off. That piece is coming off. Let's go.
Go.
In other words, Taylor Lewan has his Robert Dasmati oversized scissors ready to go. And all that stands between him and a ribbon cutting are the Kansas City Chiefs and whoever wins the NFC title game between the Packers and the 49ers. You want to talk about weird bulletin board material for the Chiefs? Andy Reid can play that clip of Lewan assuring Mike Vrabel the castration is coming and tell his team that the Titans are already looking past KC and right to the operating table. Operation Save Vrabel's Junk is now a rallying cry for the opposition. Now, to point out the obvious being that Lewan never actually bet his coach his junk. He never said, if we win the Super Bowl, you take off your banana and your grapes. That never happened. It was never an official bet, right? It was posed as a hypothetical. So I'm sure it will die as a hypothetical. Because right now, Vrabel does not need to mutilate his own Johnson to win a Super Bowl. He just needs to keep doing what he's doing. And what he's been doing is mutilating everybody in front of him. And if the Titans do pull off another shocker, and they beat the Chiefs this weekend, they will become the first team ever to rip off four straight games against division winners. Week 17, they got the Texans. Wild card round, they got the Pats. Saturday, they wood-chippered the Ravens. And now the AFC Western champs are all that's left between the Titans and a trip to Miami. No one's had a tougher path. No one's gotten up for it quite like the Titans. Two down, two to go. Two down, two to go. And I'm not talking about Vrabel stones. I don't know what's better. This guy's screaming, that piece is coming off. That piece is coming off. Let's go. Or the initial exchange, Alvin, the initial exchange of Vrabel making it clear to his young players, one day you will be married for 20 years. Believe me, you won't need it.
Would you cut your off for a Super Bowl?
Oh, been married 20 years? Yeah, probably.
You've got three.
As a player, I guess we'll be married for 20 years one day.
Would you, if you,
won't, you, won't, if need you, came it, you won't need it.
Would she be upset?
She'd probably be on board.
She would be like, do you want me to do it? Do you want to do it now?
It is incredible. He is Therese Paylor. Therese, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm fantastic, Jim. Thanks for having me on again.
Great to have you back. All right, so you spent 5 years as the Chiefs beat writer for the Kansas City Star. Let me start right there because you know the history of that team. You know the pain of the fan base. So what was going through your head when the Chiefs not only started the way they did, but they fell behind 21-0 in the first quarter and the fans were booing them at home?
Well, Jim, listen, I still got a large contingent of people on Twitter who follow me from Kansas City. So I was thinking, I'm about to start getting some really angry tweets from people, from my followers. And the column is going to have to match that, right? Everything had lined up so well for the Chiefs. I mean, the Titans even took out the Ravens, meaning that if they won the game against the Texans, they'd get to host the AFC Championship game. I mean, it's really hard to imagine the last 3 weeks going better for the Chiefs than they have. And here we go. Everything's set up. You're facing an inferior team. Your quarterback is better, albeit like not by a huge margin because I think Watson is special, but Mahomes is better. Your head coach is way better, right? And here you are, and you guys completely come out flat, and you end up being down 24-0. And I'm thinking, well, to do this is going to take a history-making effort. The Chiefs had never come back for more than 21 points in their entire history. But I also said this last week. I believe in Patrick Mahomes' gifts. I believe in his competitiveness. And I think that AFC Championship game loss a year ago changed him for the better. Not changed him, but fortified him, right? There was no way he was going to let them lose that game. I said leading up to that game all week, it'd be an over-my-dead-body game. And what he ended up doing after that, 321 passing yards, 5 touchdowns, that's what elite alpha quarterbacks do. Over-my-dead-body, we're not losing this game. And that's what ended up happening.
Therese Paylor joining us. That's exactly what ended up happening. One more thought about the vibe there. Like, it's one thing to see the vibe on Twitter. We know what that is. But when you know how beaten down that Chiefs fan base has been, how powerful was the vibe of, oh, no, not again, in the stadium in the first quarter?
Oh, it was real. I think stunned silence is a really good way to describe it. And
and speaking of stunned silence, nice job, Alvin. Speaking of stunned silence, and he's back right now. Dude, that was so funny. You said, speaking of stunned silence, and then there was more stunned silence.
Unfortunately, but I'm ready to talk to you. Hopefully that doesn't happen again. I'll continue real quick, though.
Do it.
When the stunned silence ended, it was just outright anger, just boos. And I get it. The people here have been tortured for so long, but I think they got to remember they've kind of graduated from this particular part of tortured fandom because they have the quarterback that changes it all. He makes it right. And I think that now when you come back from 24 points, you know there's no situation that you can't get out of.
I was going to say, how powerful is that? Like, when you're down 24-0 and you come back, and not just come back, but come back the way that he did, 400 yards from scrimmage, 5 touchdowns, no picks. But forget about the numbers. How powerful is that, and what's that say about Mahomes as a leader?
Well, look, Andy Reid just gave him a lot of credit today. He said that he went out of his way to say that Mahomes is really energetic and kind of prodding from the sideline. And I think that's important for your quarterback to do. One thing that was really interesting, Jim, I think you'll like this. I was talking to some of the players in the locker room on Sunday, and a lot of them kept mentioning how, like, there was no, like, sniping on the sideline even when they were down by so much. And you do find that when things go poorly in the NFL, players start sniping at each other, and coaches do too. But to a man, I heard that there was none of that. And I think one player, Anthony Sherman, the fullback, kind of summed it up nicely for me. It's because Mahomes helps with that, because they know there's no situation they can't get out of.
Terez Paylor is my guest. You know, the other guy that said something of that effect to you was Tyrann Mathieu. And, hey, listen, I don't root for players, but I've got so much respect for this guy. I have so much respect for Tyrann Mathieu and what he does. How does the Kansas City defense look to you right now?
I think they look fantastic. And I think you've got Badger, who looks like a version of Troy Polamalu. I was talking to him last week, and I'll write this at some point. This is the best version of him, right? They are using him in the Polamalu, make things happen, sniff around the box role. He thinks he's playing the best football of his career right now. And a big reason for that, Jim, is because the Chiefs have empowered him to not just do the things he does best on the field, but also, like, lead men. Like, they handed the defense to him, and they said, hey, lead these guys. And he's done that. And he's fully embraced being a member of the Kansas City Chiefs. And I think that by leading from the front, he's also played a huge role in helping this defense get to a really, actually more than functional point than they were last year.
We're talking to Terez Paylor. So if you were to look ahead, Terez, Tennessee did beat Kansas City in Nashville, 35-32 back in November when Mahomes made his return from his injury. But Derrick Henry gashed them for 188 yards, 2 touchdowns in that game. And you've pointed this out yourself. When you look at Kansas City's history against physical teams in the playoffs, the Steelers, the Titans, the Patriots, how worried should KC fans be about that matchup?
They should be a little worried just because Henry is on the best playoff run for a running back in 2 decades. You got to go back to Terrell Davis to kind of find a guy who's doing what he's doing right now. And he's an incredible running back. And he like you said, he ran for almost 200 yards against them 2 months ago. But I'll also say this. The Chiefs are different now than they were then. They've got some run stuffers that are good at establishing the line of scrimmage. And they also seem much more confident. They play downhill better than they did back then. They seem more aggressive and assertive. They know what they're doing. You know, when you face Tennessee, the foundation of their offense is handing the football to Derrick Henry on the outside zone, and they use other concepts too. But if you can't stop that, you're not stopping them. There has to be 8, 9 in the box, and you have to make Ryan Tannehill, who threw for like 88 yards in the last game, win. You have to make him beat you. Now, he can do it with his legs. He's a good. He's like a more experienced Josh Allen. He's a big guy. Like, he can really run. And he's tough to bring down, too. And he hurt him in their last game by doing that. But you have to make him beat you with his arm. He's got to – for the Titans to go to the Super Bowl, he's going to have to make some throws in this game. More big-time throws than he had to make through the first 2 rounds of the playoffs. You can take that to the bank.
Terez Paylor joining us. All right, so before we leave that topic, as you tweeted this morning – and again, it's early in the week, but you did tweet this morning that Andy Reid says he's not sure what Chris Jones's availability will be on Sunday. How big of a concern would that be for Kansas City?
You know, it's a concern because I'm telling you, Jim, I've watched a lot of football, man. And, you know, Tennessee's offensive line is, as a run-blocking group, this is about as physical and as nasty as a group as I've seen in a long time, right? Roger Saffold, Taylor Lewan, Big Jack Conklin, these guys, hat on hat, they move you. That line surges off the football. They dominated the New England Patriots up front. And the Baltimore Ravens have a really good defensive front. Guess what? Titans dominated them too. So the more bodies you have, the better. They're going to come, and there's no secret what they're going to try to do. The Titans are going to get cute. They play grown man football. They're going to line up here. You're going to know what's coming. And they're going to dare you to not only meet their physicality and match it, with the tackle, their 6'3", 250-pound running back. And if you can do it, you have a chance. But no one's been able to do it in 2 months.
That is well said. They do play grown man football. Therese Paylor, my guest. Listen, I'm coming to KC this weekend, and you know that town really well. I'm coming to be a part of the NFL Today pregame show. What kind of a scene should I prepare for in KC? What's it going to be like?
It's incredible because the people here believe it's going to be a coronation. They made it to the AFC Championship game last year, Jim. And they were down early in that game, too. But you kind of first saw the glimpses of Mahomes' playoff greatness then. Like, the next logical step is for the Chiefs to beat this team that they're better than on paper and go to the Super Bowl finally. There's a lot of optimism here, and people here are crazy about their Chiefs. Don't forget, this is a football town, right? This is a place, this is one of the smallest markets in football, but they're always around the top of the league in attendance. And if you've never come to a game at Arrowhead Stadium, it is one of the last few college-like atmospheres in the NFL. This place is football in a lot of different ways. And for the AFC Championship game to be here for the second straight year, it's going to be crazy. You're really going to enjoy it, man. And I think anybody, if you love the game of football, you've got to come make a pilgrimage to Arrowhead Stadium at least one time.
I absolutely love that town, and I could not agree with you anymore. That is a football town, and they love that team. And after that comeback, I'm sure they believe anything could happen. But, man, you can't. You know this. You cannot sleep on the Titans. They play grown man football, to your point. And I don't care what that line says. I don't care what people say. That is a tough team. That is no gimme. That is going to be a battle.
You got it. And, again, if you love football, it's one you got to watch. Because I want to say something really quick here.
Sure.
It's really important for people to understand how important what the Titans are doing right now is to the game of football. Because all we heard last year, and I played a little role in this too. I wrote this, that it's a passing league now, right? The NFL is about passing. But one thing we forgot, and one thing is really important to remember now, because the 49ers have shown this, the Ravens have shown this, and the Titans have shown this, and the Vikings too. Running the football is not going to go out of style here, okay? It's just not. If you can win up front, that matters in January because the game changes. It becomes about who can establish and impose their will on the other team and control the football game. The Patriots won a Super Bowl doing that last year, and we all forgot it. But this year, all these teams here, basically except the Chiefs, they're about running the football, and they're dominating doing it. So it's kind of cool to see the league get back to what was always considered a winning formula because, to be honest, football is at its best when the game is balanced. The run game is beautiful and so is the pass. When teams do both, that makes the game awesome.
It's such a good point, and so much for that notion that the running back position has been completely devalued. No, it has not. He is a senior NFL writer for Yahoo. He is a Hall of Fame voter. He is the co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast, Therese Paylor, back in the jungle. Therese, my man, great job. Really appreciate you.
Thanks, Jim. You know I'm a Detroit guy, which means I love Isaiah Thomas, and I always want to say this on your show. Ward's is getting back from Red Lobster.
Jerome in Houston. Jerome, what's up?
Hey, thanks for the vine, Vance Mack. Love your show as always. Thanks to Mr. Hawk for getting me through. This Texans team, I tell you, it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That's the only way I can put it. Up 24-0, and I was watching the game with a couple of my buddies and my kids who were damn near 40. But anyway, we were up 24-0, and the first thing we started looking at each other and thinking about Oilers of 92 when they were up on the Buffalo Bills 31-3 and blew that one. And we knew then this ain't going to last because the Packers are better coached. Bill O'Brien is a horse's ass boob. He's slightly, maybe average, maybe slightly above average, and he's got this team that's got the talent to compete with anybody, and it's just aggravating in this city. And prof to you, and thanks for the vine. I'm out.
My man, good job, Jerome. Alvin, you can rack him.
Good night.